My name is Josh, and welcome to Conversations with Two Geeks, a podcast where we talk about movies, comics, and everything in between. Today, on this very special episode of Conversations with Two Geeks, no, this is not a normal special episode, but still a special episode, I will be interviewing, or rather, having a conversation with, the great journalist, now-turned-author, Marie Mo Ryan. Say hi, Mo. As the two of us talk about her hit book, one that I've recommended on the podcast, Burn It Down, Power, Complicity, and a Call to Change in Hollywood, we'll be discussing everything from the book to its inspirations to the tragic stories within it, what can be done to change Hollywood for the better, and the real response and acclaim the book has gotten. So yeah, please follow us on all our social media pages. We're in conversation with Two Geeks at Twitter and Instagram. You can email us about this and any other episode at conversationwithtwogeeks@gmail.com. Also, you can find our back catalog on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever podcasts are listened to. So yeah, this has been months in the making, y'all. Like, I've been wanting to get Mo on for a very long time. First off, hi, Mo. Again.
Hi.
And like, literally, we've been talking about this for months. I can't remember which episode I recommended the book, but when I got the book, I knew I was like, I have to get you on and stuff. So would you mind introducing us to the audience and stuff, Mo?
Yeah, my name is, the name on the book is Maureen Ryan. Most people call me Mo, and I've been covering the entertainment industry in one form or another for, gosh, over 30 years, something like that. I've been a journalist.
Oh, wow.
And I've also done some more or less regular news, if you will, during that time frame as well. But over time, I transitioned more and more into TV and film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, like I've been reading most stuff since at least 2019, when Jeff Garland got fired.
I don't know what to call it either. I honestly do not know what to call it. So yes, it was a confusing time, put it that way.
Yeah, no. And since then, yeah. And again, like, this is a great book. I highly recommend folks check it out and stuff, but I will say it is a hard read. It took me weeks to get through the first half. The second half was a bit more easier, but like, yeah, it did. And I won't lie, as someone that also works in behind the scenes and has kind of dealt with some things, with some shit, I'm just gonna call it that, dealt with some shit. I said this before we started recording, this was kind of a therapy session.
Yeah, I mean, all of the things you just said, those are reactions that I completely understand and that seem to be, you know, not unusual. And you know, again, before the session, when you said it was like a therapy session, I feel like that's a compliment, because I didn't mm-hmm. expect my career to go this way. Okay. But I think a lot of my career has ended up being me saying to other people within the entertainment industry, yeah, it's not you. It's not just you. I also see this thing that you are being mm-hmm. basically propagandized into thinking that A, you shouldn't see, or B, it's not a bad thing to be experiencing. It's like, there's so much, and honestly, the book could not have come about had I not gone through a transformation of realizing, I don't know if I want to say I'd been tricked, but like, you know, Hollywood is very good at image, right? Mm-hmm. Image management, like that's really what it's mm-hmm. about. And so, you know, I think I will be forever working out in my head. You know, look, all of us as human beings, we want to put our best foot forward. We want people mm-hmm. to like us, or we want, you know, to get approval, mm-hmm. affirmation, praise mm-hmm. for our work, all of that. So how much of my erroneous thoughts about the industry or erroneous impressions, how much of that was just people trying to put their best foot forward, or studios or companies or films mm-hmm. or TV productions mm-hmm. trying to present the best possible version of themselves, which again, I as one human being, I do that. Mm-hmm. And how much of it was, we're going to cover up our complicity with, I'm just going to say it, evil.
Yeah.
You know, evil dynamics, negative and, you know, negative, toxic, whatever you want to call it, abusive environments and people, how much of it was covering that stuff up? And I'll never truly know that. Like, I can't, mm-hmm. I don't have a TARDIS. I'm not Doctor Who. I can't go back and like see what was a cover up and what was just somebody trying to like not look bad. But yeah, it's been a long refrain in my career, which I kind of to be the one saying, yeah, no, I see that too. And I think in part because, as you know, there are a lot of industries in which it is risky to, you know, blow the whistle on poor treatment. Like basically every industry, every job, there's no scenario in which that's an easier fun thing. But in extremely gate-kept industries, if you will, a lot of the creative industries, and the thing is, I hope that people take this from the book, and I think that this did sort of have this impression. What I write about in the book applies to architecture, photography, theater, you know, anything creative, you know, fine art, you know, whatever you want to, whenever there's a very, very difficult path to earning a sustainable living where you can actually buy food and have a place to live and is also considered creative, there's a great deal of energy expended toward this idea that you're lucky to be here. Why are you asking for things like decent treatment, humane working conditions, and money?
Yeah,
you're just lucky to be here.
or even decent.
Right, money's a thing. Calling to do this or that. Like, I truly believe that some people are, you know, called to be artists, called to be creative. That is a deep part of their whole makeup. But you know what? They're also doing a job for money. And 99 times out of 10, they're doing this job for companies that are for-profit enterprises, or even something like, I don't know, PBS or something that's not officially for-profit. People need to get paid for their creative output because nobody can live on praise or affirmation. When I need to pay my electric bill, no one's going to be like, well, you know, people, so-and-so liked your book. That's not going to cut it with the people who, you know, I pay for my phone service.
like everyone got to pay rent. I mean, for Christ's sake, it's funny you say that, because like at the time of this recording, it is the 30th and rent's due tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I'm just like,
people in the industry struggle, but I think, and I don't know, you could tell me this, you know, being, I don't live in LA. I do know a lot of people, and I'm talking to people in the industry every day, almost, you know, really, really informally off the record most of the time. And so we're just like kind of shooting the breeze and checking in. But yeah, every single person I know, including, you know, I've been in the homes of people who are number one on the call sheet for, you know, a high profile production on networks and films you've heard of. And maybe I'm just hanging out with the wrong people, but they are not living large. They're not living in the Entourage mansion. Most people, if they reach some kind of sustained success, as it is, you know, I guess codified within the industry, they are usually doing that within or living in a place that's expensive. And I think, you know, one of the things I'm glad about in the last few years, I think I would date it from Me Too onward, but certainly like the last few years, certainly the year of the big strike year we just had, there's been a wonderful demystification and deglamorization of the entertainment industry.
Oh, hell yeah.
If you live in New York, if you live in London, if you live in Vancouver, Toronto, LA, even Austin, Texas, even Chicago, you know, anywhere that's a production center, rents, house prices, food prices, all of those things have gone up stratospherically. And, you know, the people who brought attention to starting a couple, 2-3 years ago, like Pay Up Hollywood, a thing that absolutely melted a lot of established industry people's brains was finding out that their assistants were making what they made as assistants, you know, 16 years ago. The studio had not increased people's pay commensurate with inflation. And as you know, from when I began going to LA in 1992 till now, track the housing prices, like I would say the average place to live, rent, or own has easily tripled, if not quadrupled. People, sometimes bosses of places, oh, you should live out here in LA, or you should live here in New York. And I'm like, with what you're paying me? you're aware of what you're paying me, right? Like, what are we talking about here? Like, there's what? I don't know what, like, you maybe you would have had to buy a house in LA in like 1934, and then like then you could continue to live there, but then you would also be 90 years old, and you know, like it's not a thing where people are lucky to be here. They're working hard. It's hard to break in. It's even harder, I think, to stay in. And it's very, very hard to earn a decent living. And I think the average person in the public now has a different impression. Because, you know, when I was covering the strike, the writer's strike of 2007, 2008, I was working as, where was I working then? I was working at the Chicago Tribune. And so average people here, you know, here in the Midwest, we're like, why are these rich millionaires, like, why are they such crybabies? You don't get that now. I got very little of that, and I saw very little of it on social media. Like, I did think there was occasionally I in real life or online would get a comment of like, but they're all, you know, industry fat cats, or you know, whatever you're gonna call it, like rich people, like prosperous, whatever. And I'm like, it has gotten so much harder to sustain a living ever since streaming came along, and that was the big bait and switch. I actually interviewed Mike Schur of, you know, Parks and Recreation and A Good Place about this, and I did a couple columns about it for Vanity Fair 3 almost 4 years ago, because I was like, wait a minute, the big promise of streaming was your show can be as long as it needs to be, your film can be as long as it needs to be. We're not going to box you in and say it has to be 22 episodes or 13 or 14 or 10. It can be what you need it to be. Everyone said, yeah, cool, man. And also the big bait and switch was, we'll pay you more money up front than the broadcast networks, or those broadcast sort of network oriented streamer or studios will, but you don't get residuals, not certainly not in the same way. And they're much, you know, this is the reason for the strike. The shorthand that I've been telling people all year is, so think about it, the major guilds negotiate with the Producers Alliance every 3 years. There was a near strike by the Writers Guild in 2017, and I was still at Variety then. And so I covered that, and they really came to the brink. But I have watched the Writers Guild transform itself. I mean, I think that the Writers Guild has attained a lot for its members over the years in the face of massive resistance over the decades. But it has definitely become a guild where many more people at all levels, millionaires on down, are aware that, as we've been talking about, like, this is the models that are currently prevalent are not sustainable for people to have realistic careers over time. And so really, in 2020, though, you know, the Directors Guild contract came up, the Writers Guild contract came up. Everyone punted those negotiations down the road because COVID was raging actively at that time. They did get some gains, but the major consensus was, we're not going to go out on strike while our members are already out of work from the pandemic. That was not anything anyone wanted. So really, I did expect at least one strike this year, if not more, because the streaming revolution that began around, I want to say 2011, 12, 13, and really gained steam around 2014, 15, 16. We were well overdue, or the industry was long overdue in terms of addressing the structural and compensation changes that that revolution wrought. It was, you know, it should have been in 2020 realistically, or could have been, but it got punted to 2023. And I think it's also telling that the IATSE strike authorization vote last year was like 99% authorization. And so I think the level of disgruntlement is really, really high, and I understand why.
Yeah, no, like, you know, as someone that was also on the ground, picketing and stuff, you know, the way the, and also as a PWGA writer, just the boots on the, just from hearing everyone's stories from the mini rooms to everything about that and stuff, like, and also like, you mentioned the whole thing about the upfront pay that still happened. Like, there was a whole news story today about how, like, since Disney took over the streaming, pretty much took over the streaming rights, the streaming residual for Doctor Who and stuff, like, the residuals have been like shortening, or they're barely existing. Like, people are getting an upfront pay, but like no residuals and stuff, which is just Jesus fucking Christ.
And the thing is, you know, residuals were fought for over many years, and I, you know, something I want to talk about a little bit at least is the altruism that exists in the industry. And it's very much the thing in the industry, especially if you cover it. There's what I call the cynicism Olympics. You know, there's something among reporters that cover this industry that says it's kind of as a protective device. You have to be as cynical as possible. And you people like literally, I feel like, get into contests of who can be the most nihilistic and cynical and negative. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I have those days too, believe me. But overall, the reason that that there has ever been a middle class or a sustainable class of artisans and artists in commercial Hollywood is because of the guilds. Starting almost 100 years ago, guild activists began fighting this idea that we're all a family. I'm like, man, have you met families? Families are messed up. Like, most families are like, not, you know, they got problems. I'm just going to say it.
Yeah,
so
no.
They've been saying for 100 years, no, we're not going to take this paternalistic pennies on the dollar that you might hand out if we're good little, you know, worker bees who don't say anything and don't do anything. So one of the things that the Writers Guild in particular and other guilds have fought for too, but the Writers Guild in particular, decades ago, were in a stalemate with the producers and they wanted residuals, which is, again, this is the thing that allowed Hollywood to exist and to make a lot of the stuff that you and I both love, that we cry over, that we buy the action figures from, that we are devoted to. Residuals allow someone who is a craft, who is an artist, an artisan who is working on their craft, tides them over in very expensive places to live to the next job. But what the studio said was, fine, okay, we'll give the Writers Guild residuals, but only going forward. We're not going to reach into the past and go over our books and give everyone presently in the Writers Guild residuals for everything they ever did in the past. If you wrote that hit movie, the number one movie of last year, like, it's only for starting on this day, residuals will start. And you know what the Writers Guild membership did? They said, okay. And this was, I want to say, more than 50 years ago, 50 or 50 plus years ago, people in the guild, thousands of people said, I will forego that payday for me as an individual so that generations coming up can sustain themselves. And realistically, I want to beat this drum forever. Because they made that sacrifice, a lot of the stuff that I love exists. If it were not for Hollywood guilds, the middle class in the industry, you know, the costume assistant who becomes the costume designer, the PA who becomes, you know, the camera operator, you know, all these people who are able to get into these jobs and kind of graduate and go higher and higher in their careers, you know, a lot of the big fight for SAG-AFTRA this summer was about how extras are treated.
Yeah.
Most of the actors that you've heard of, a lot of them started out as extras.
Yeah, Matt Damon even talked about this in Hot Ones for crying out, for Christ's sake.
Right? Like, so the thing is, like, you know, I did have someone say to me at one point, oh, well, you know, such and so actor is rich. Why are they agitating? Why are they part of this guild action for actors? And I said, because... no, we should be applauding that.
Yeah.
For the richest members to turn around and say, look, I'm secure, but I'm going to fight so that everybody is more secure more of the time.
Mm-hmm.
That is what should happen, and we should applaud that. Like, I'm really glad that Margot Robbie's rich. Like, it doesn't hurt me if she has a nice house, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Viola Davis has a really beautiful mansion. Great, you know,
that's great. I mean, Viola, it deserves that.
Exactly. I'm like, it's not a zero sum thing, because I don't know what you think of this. I think that the strikes were over. The dunderheads who were in the Producers Guild didn't understand this, but like, the strikes were over before they began, because all people needed to do on social media is do screenshots of what these CEOs were making and have made. I've been beating that drum, I gotta say, I'm gonna blow my own horn a little bit. I've been beating the drum on David Zaslav's 2021 compensation since 2021. You can go back and look at my tweets for the last 2 years. I've been like, Somebody explain to me how one man deserved for 1 year's employment $250 million. Somebody, yeah. I don't care if you explain that to me, actually, because it's nonsense, because I'm hearing about assistants having to live in their cars.
Yeah. And
at that studio, or, you know, not having a reliable source of food aside from the power bars that they steal from work.
Yeah, no. Yeah, no. Like, I just, Zaslav. I'm pretending to do a strength. I'm pretending to do a strength thing, because, like, ever since that man got hired, it has been nothing but just, well, the exception of one thing, but, like, downhill.
Downhill, of course. And the thing is, we could devote the whole podcast to clowning Zaslav. And believe me, I have done that. I'm seriously. But I think it's more useful to think of him as an avatar. He is an avatar of what private equity did to journalism, which is hollow it out, strip it for parts, leave nothing but destruction and a ruined ecosystem in your wake. But a few guys who were already rich got richer. Again, I don't love that, but the only... I told people on those picket lines, and I'll tell it to you, someone who walked the picket lines too. I honestly, that is one of the most inspiring things that's ever happened. Not just that the Writers Guild went on strike, but SAG joined them. When I would see pictures of those trucks from the Teamsters turning around, that's the kind of shit that makes me cry, because I'm like, you know what? That's not a small action. That is not a small action, because it's, you know, there has been much, much more union action in many spheres, and guilds are forming at, you know, Starbucks, big box stores all over. And we understand why, right? Because, again, this very small tier of people at the top are hollowing out many, many things in the world so that they can get richer, and everyone else is just kept down at the lowest levels. But what I would say to people, I'm like, look, I'm not minimizing how stressful and hard it is, the financial burdens. People were worried about feeding their families, feeding themselves. And I get that, like 100% that's real. But I said, if it helps alongside all of that, again, not displacing it, not minimizing it, the guilds provided to the world with some of the most high profile faces in the world and names in the world. And many, many, many 200 days of what solidarity looks like. What those guilds said was it seems like, oh, well, these are unstoppable forces of capitalism that cannot be checked. They were checked. These people hung together and realized, and this is the thing I find in my reporting. And this is why, again, I don't want to play the cynicism Olympics with people. I mean, I can with my friends when we're both like having a really terrible day, but like,
yeah. Also with like a glass of wine and stuff.
Exactly. But overall, can one person make a difference? Yeah.
Yeah.
Lucas Till came to me and talked about work conditions that were terrible. And what Lucas Till, the star of MacGyver, told me was, I would listen to things that he told me that he went through and other people confirmed, and they were terrible. And I would say, I'm so sorry this happened. He wasn't as upset about what happened to him as about what was being done to specific coworkers and to that workplace in general. So, and I'm not even singling him out, because other people, you know, many people for the Lost chapter in my book spoke out with their names attached. So in every one of those cases, one or two or three people had to come forward and just say, I'm going to, for the good of my set or for the good of my workplace, I'm going to tell the truth, and I'm going to stand firm in my truth. But together, the thing is, together, those groups of people, a lot of the stories that I've done, yeah, sure, there were established people or senior people or, you know, high level producer people. Sure, of course. I've dealt with many people who are trying to change the industry and using their positions and their relative security to do it. But a lot of the people I've talked to are people that the industry would describe as nobodies. But those nobodies changed the world.
And yeah, no, and like just this year, sorry, you know when like someone says something epic and it's like I have no words. I 1,000% agree because like they did. They did.
They did, and they will, and that's the big lie. The big lie of the industry is, well, you can't do X or Y or Z, or you'll never work again, or you'll be. People are blacklisted, don't get me wrong. I'm certainly aware that that still happens, but like so it's interesting. I read something recently, an article about psychology that I thought was so applicable to Hollywood, and that is a single digit percent of people can be described as sociopaths or psychopaths, you know, lacking empathy. And obviously within that there are gradations of that. Now, more than 50% of human beings, according to psychological studies, are not that. Like they are, you know, reasonably decent, reasonably counted on to like not do psychopathic things. My beef at this point in time with the industry is the 40% of people who let shit happen, because if they think it might benefit them, they'll be protected by it, they'll be somehow gain something from it. And I'm like, here's the thing. I understand that everybody, I certainly feel like retroactively looking at it, I've enabled some things I wish I hadn't and I didn't fully understand at the time. But I think that there is a subset of people in the industry who, in a way, are more dangerous than the actual abusers or toxic monsters or exploiters financially or in other ways. Because there's a block of people who will say, well, I'm a good person, but you're letting this happen and you have the juice to, you know, help stop it among the group of people stopping this, and you're choosing not to. What have beef with?
Yeah, no, I'm just now thinking of just to use an example from the book and stuff. The Saturday Night Live bit. Yeah, and like just the amount of because here's the thing, I knew because the thing I think you even like broke that, like I would say I feel like you broke that originally. And I remember reading it and stuff, and I remember reading it, it's like, okay, I knew about this whole situation with Horatio Sands and stuff, but like, you know, just the amount of people that like even kind of knew about it, I'm like, Jesus fucking Christ. And you think someone would say
Well,
something and
yeah, I mean,
stuff.
actually, I want to give credit to a writer at Daily Beast, Laura Bradley, who I think she and Seth Simons are two writers who did a lot of basically the groundwork reporting of that. I think, yeah, I mean, the reason, you know, you said you had a tough time, you know, reading the first that the, that first set of chapters. I totally get it. I had a tough time writing them. That was one of the ones where it was like, well, this is going to end me. And really, there were many reasons that that was a struggle, but one of them was the Horatio Sands situation and the allegations surrounding him and the lawsuit surrounding him and the lawsuit that was settled, by the way. And the survivor didn't sign an NDA, by the way. So that's interesting. That is the fruit of a poisonous tree that was planted 50 years ago. This was not just, well, it's a one-off. And that's what I think. That really is why I wrote the book. None of this shit is one-offs. I mean, like I don't, I'm at the point now where it's like, oh, do a story on this DP or do a story on this one person or whatever. And I'm like, what would that prove except that the systems of enabling are still in place? The systems of denial and blacklisting and gaslighting are still in place. And
And
those systems are harder to uproot, but the systems are what I'm more interested in uncovering at this point.
especially, and I'll just be the guy that says this, especially when it comes to racial, and
Oh,
especially
yeah.
racial stuff. Like I'm, for example, my mind's now going to like the Sleepy Hollow bit because I'll be upfront about this. I watched the show back and when it was airing back in like 2013. And loved the first season. And then and like in real time, I noticed the like the drop in quality writing. And I was always like, what the fuck is going on?
Oh, dude, hard same, like so hard same. Like I didn't understand it. Like literally for 10 years, it's been in my brain of like, there's either it's a fault in my brain or a great thing about my brain, but I'm like, I have to know why. And one of the reasons why is that the American television industry is fucking racist. I'm just going to say it. You know, like, it's not, please understand.
I'm with you on this.
Look, again, I mean, I'm just circling back to what I said earlier, about not knowing things, right? So I will absolutely make it as, I don't know, maybe it's the South Side of Chicago in me or something, but I'm like, I don't like to dance around things. I come from, you know, clueless white lady land, right? And like, I came out of college, you know, in a way, in the early 90s. And it's like, oh, well, we fixed all the feminism stuff that fixed sexism. And then, you know, isn't in my oblivious white lady bubble. And then, you know, Barack Obama's elected. So now, you know what, we officially really and truly fixed the whole American race debacle. We did not. I mean, like, so a lot of obliviousness came together. But the thing is, I'm really glad that, I don't know, how do I even come at this? On my deathbed, I can say this. I at least uncovered what happened at that show, and I talked about why it happened, and I hopefully ripped the scab off of this festering sore that is racism in Hollywood, because what you have in Hollywood is, and again, I've been traveling in those realms for 30 years, and part of the reason I stick with covering it is because I like a lot of the people in it, right?
Yeah.
And when I say that there's racism embedded in the industry, I'm also talking about Mo Ryan, person who covered the industry. I fucked up. I'm just going to say that. So when I was like, oh, such and so was racist, I'm part of that. I'm not excluding myself from that. But what I wanted to do is, and this is, you know, I talked to that rabbi about, like, how do you make amends? How do you atone? How do you, I could atone for me being an oblivious, I don't know, Karen adjacent person. I could at least do that. I had the juice. So what I, like, this is really, I had the position and the juice, and someone in the press is outside of the studio. I wasn't working for Fox. You know, I wasn't on the payroll of Sleepy Hollow. We are apart from it. So ideally we should have enough distance to actually get into the reality of it. And I wouldn't have been able to had, you know, Orlando Jones and many other people been willing to speak on it and talk about what really happened. And I'm just someone, as you can tell already, probably, like, I emotionally bond with not just the things that I like, but the fandoms that, you know, and obviously some fandoms have, you know, complete assholes in them. But, like, you know, I was a big booster of Doctor Who from way back, because I first saw Doctor Who when I was 10, you know, and I'm like, I saw how much people were digging Sleepy Hollow. And then I was like you, I was like, am I losing my mind? This is bad. Why is it like this? And that had to be the longest chapter in the book, because it's complicated. It both is and isn't complicated. I mean, and I would love to get your take on it. Like, the complicated part of it is, Hollywood people want to be able to say the following always. I'm one of the good ones. I'm not just excluding myself, and this refers to LGBTQ issues, to race, to gender, to any number of things. Everyone in this world, I think, wants to be able to say, I'm one of the good ones, right?
Yeah.
The higher you go in Hollywood, the fewer people are willing to speak the truth to you.
Yeah.
I wish, if I did have a time machine, I would go back to 2014 and say, okay, so in season two, you're all about to really, really mess up this thing. And you've now already demonized, quite literally demonized, one of the most promising actors of her generation, Nicole Bahama. What the fuck's going on here? And no one would have wanted to hear that, because they're all like, no, but we're doing a great thing here. We have a multiracial cast and this, that, and the other. I'm like,
it's one of the highest rated shows of Fox.
I firmly believe and this could be this is a this statement is applicable to many situations in Hollywood, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
It's much worse to give people false hope than no hope at all. They raise the expectations of genre fans, especially Black genre fans, with by not fucking up much in that first season. Like, it was just like, hey, it's a cool, fun show. If this is all happening, it's like, I will, as I've said in many Twitter threads and on social media many times, I will go to my grave convinced this is a really fucking good premise.
Yeah.
Oh, so you had a free ancestor in the colonial times who was, you know, kind of like, you know, a spy for, like, and like, but she had this book of lore and all of this. This is all great. This is all so good and so interesting. I still want a comic book series. I still want a like a rebooted TV series. But don't give people false hope that you are gonna do right by them and then spectacularly do wrong by them and then every step of the way demonize the fans for pointing out the very real shitty shit that you're doing.
Yeah, no, definitely. And just like I'm just going back to some of my memories with that show, and the fact that I was only 14 when that show came out, and I noticed that says a lot. But like, to toot my own horn a little bit, but like, just
people felt the vibes like were not right in season two, and then by season three, it's like, well, were you trying to mess this up as catastrophically as you could? Because you know you're doing a great job. If that was the goal, no notes. You're doing great. If the goal was take this really cool premise and interesting cast, and in what world do you take Orlando Jones and completely sideline his character and mess up the business end of it so bad that he's like, nah, I'm out? What is happening? Like, you are doing, you're bad at your job if that's how that shakes out.
And then also
on screen and behind the scene.
Yeah, and then also blacklisting again Nicole Ferrari. Like, she was amazing. And still to me, I haven't seen The Morning Show, but I've heard good things.
Right.
And the fact that she's been blacklisted to this very day, honestly, still is baffling.
There's nothing that can undo that. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, like that's the kind of thing I come across in my work. People all the time who were driven out of the industry, were sidelined, or had long gaps in their career because of, you know, horrific reasons. Not because it's like, were they willing to work hard? Yes. Were they good at what they did? Yes. Were they willing to get better at what they did? Also, yes. Were they good collaborators and coworkers? Yes, again. But they're not in the industry because of bullshit.
Yeah.
Or they left or they came back, whatever it is. And that is, no, you know, you don't get to say I'm one of the good ones when you catastrophically, and like, I will never forgive that. I don't know if it's in my nature, but I will never forgive that a member of the PR staff called me and other reporters to spread this allegation about Nicole Beharie. I'm like, I don't even understand. I mean, to this day, this happened in 2016, and I gotta tell you, it took me years to even figure out how can I safely write about this so that I don't get sued, so that I can actually bring it to light in context. And that chapter needed many, many words of context. But at the end of the day, that's not difficult to understand. That was a studio engaging in the most heinous. I don't even know if I have the words for it. It absolutely, I mean, when she came out and was promoting Miss Juneteenth, even like I could even tell then, she certainly spoke on her experience, but also to me, rereading those reviews in preparation for writing the book, she was circumscribed in what she could say.
Yeah, she was holding back.
She had to hold back. And the thing is, I approached her team to see if she would talk to me, and she very politely, through her reps, declined. And here's the thing, I get it.
Yeah.
What's the upside for her? We've been through hell.
You know, and
with that chapter, and this is really my intent with that, and with Lost, and with Saturday Night Live, is to say, this is one cautionary tale amongst many.
Yeah.
What I wanted those chapters to be, really, all of the chapters in some way or other, this is just one example that I'm picking out from a pile of examples. If you think that Sleepy Hollow was the only instances where these kind of horrific, you know, dynamics went on a number of fronts. If you think that's the only place it happened, the whole point of my book is to say this is just one example of many.
Yeah.
And certainly in Lost and in Sleepy Hollow and a few other instances, yeah, you know, a lot, you know, Black actors, Asian actors, Latina actors, like they have had to contend with a system that said, oh no, we're the good ones. There's no race issues here. But at the same time, you know, if you're a Native American actor, you only get, you know, one or two scenes in which your character gets no development. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there's just patterns that they've had to be quiet about if they even wanted to stay on the path of being a performer or writer or director. You had to shut up about it. And my whole thing is that I will not shut up. As
Yeah,
you can
no,
tell.
yeah, no, yeah, no. And like, shit. Okay. All right. So yeah, like it's like not like just with everything and stuff. And again, as I said before, your book was a therapy session because I've worked in some very high profile productions, including a movie that's potential that's recent that's about to come out soon. Let's just say was a really bad production and like people were passing out and stuff. So there's like obviously a hate and health and safety thing. And you think that, and this is just, and it blows my mind. And I've been thinking about this, you know, as someone that wants to work in the industry, but also as someone that, you know, reports about this like almost every week. Like you think that like the people up top would like be a leader and make sure to take care of everyone's safety and stuff. And I know there's like hundreds of thousands of people that work on a film set every day and stuff, and not and you're not going to be able to do that, but at least like you would be aware and like try to at least mitigate those situations so that way you wouldn't have stuff like, for example, the upcoming film that I and many others wind up passing out on.
Yeah, no, I mean, but here's the thing, and this was again, like you can't go through life 100% cynical. That's not a great headspace to live in, but the foundational concept behind Hollywood, commercial Hollywood is, or commercial TV and film is, if these people aren't willing to take it, we'll get more who will, because it's glamorous, right?
Yeah.
The whole thing is founded on the idea of, we will go through people like, you know, used Kleenex. We don't, like, we will just, like, and that, no one wants to say that out loud. I feel like in a weird way that's devolved to, you know, certain, like, you know, rabble rousers in the industry, certainly not just me in the press. But the foundational idea of the Hollywood machine is, I mean, at the height of the Depression, they could treat people on set however they wanted, because even getting that small amount that you got every day for being on set, they could get other people who would do it if you wouldn't. You know what I mean? And that's the thing that people don't want to say out loud. I don't think it affects every production. I certainly don't. I've, you know, been part of or been aware of productions where that was certainly not the norm and people did take care. But for a very long time, callousness and a willing to exploit was basically the backbone, and still in many ways is the backbone of the business model. And the business model is, how can we make the thing that will make the most money for the smallest budget.
Yeah.
And you see that now. You see it now where it's like Netflix or other people saying, oh, well, these four assistant jobs, let's make them one job. That's not a thing. You cannot do that. That's not realistic. You know, the two head guys at Netflix are making $25, $30 million a year.
Yeah.
Do they care? If you know, like, they're not the ones in the trenches. And the thing is, here's something that is collateral damage in the industry every single day of the week. I know showrunners and high-level producers who have said and who have fought that stuff, and sometimes they win. But as you know, in any job that anyone ever has, you only have so many chances to fight the machine.
Yeah.
And, you know, a showrunner, I'm certainly more aware of like how TV operates maybe than film, but like, or a producer, whatever it is, you only have so many battles you can fight and fronts that you can fight on. And if they're constantly coming at you with, well, cut this many filming days, combine these jobs, work the crew this many hours. Don't, like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The forces arrayed against even people who want to do the right thing, and perhaps mm-hmm. even you would think would have the status to consistently do the right thing, the forces arrayed against them are large. Mm-hmm. And if we don't talk about that, then it doesn't change.
Yeah, no. And like, just, yeah, I know. And I'm just thinking just about your book and just the crux of it and just how the leadership needs to change just in, well, both in general, but just so that way it can just be a much more healthier workplace.
Oh, completely. And I'm very much convinced that
mm-hmm.
a humane workplace is a cheaper workplace to pay for, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, that was one of the reasons I highlighted Melinda Hsu Taylor in my book very, very strongly.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, she's had an incredible history in terms of being a writer creator. She worked on Medium, she worked on Lost,
mm-hmm.
she worked on any number of shows that, you know, you've heard of. But then, you know, a number of the shows that she worked on in somewhat recent years have been on the CW, and everyone knows the CW is not the high budget place to work. You know what I mean? Like, it's not,
yeah.
Like, I'm not telling it a tale.
Oh yeah, no. Yeah, no.
But how do you make that? And I've talked, like, and I can also connect, you know, Vince Gilligan.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard that he's, you know, profligate or over budget or anything like that. But part of the reason costs are kept down, institutional memory and coworker cohesion is up, is because people don't leave those jobs on Vince Gilligan shows. And Melinda Hsu Taylor, you know, offered up just once, you know, when I was reporting on a different thing, oh, well, we were able to get a writer for Nancy Drew. This writer had other options on the table that maybe would have paid more, but this person chose to come work with us because I transparently laid out how our workplace would work
mm-hmm.
and how our workplace norms were arrived at and how we could help them advance in their career
mm-hmm.
in a humane and, you know, ideally even enjoyable way.
Yeah, because
that person took a job with Melinda and her team.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I genuinely think that, man, there are people I have reported on where the chaos and damage and destruction they created on the regular cost the studio money.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm just, like, for example, like, and the reason I'm having, like, I'm just thinking of just, like, proper examples. And also one thing I'm kind of, and you're right about that, like, it costs the money. So you think from a financial point of view, it's just like, well, let's get rid of the thing.
Right. Well, here's the thing. I never, ever, ever believe when people say, oh, well, we're really focused on being budget conscious.
Mm-hmm.
I think that can be true for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But often what the people at the top want is the next promotion, the next job, the bigger mm-hmm. paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there have been destructive people who have been tolerated because that destructive and damaging and costly person was connected to someone the studio wanted to keep a good relationship with. Mm-hmm. So that director being out of control, or that, you know, EP being out of control and damaging people, mm-hmm. they were seen as having the protection of somebody that the studio wanted to remain in business with. So it was mm-hmm. allowed to continue. And again, it's like, I also think that there's a fair degree of just simple denial.
Yeah.
And also there's a big mentality too, and I'm sure you've come across it too. Well, you're just not tough enough for this industry.
There's also that, and trust me, I've dealt with that. I've dealt with that. So there's that and stuff, and I'm just, and just the enable, it's really just enable it. And
yeah,
it's enabling.
I think that, I actually think, mm-hmm. I do think that if there's one thing designed to get me into a rage mode, it's this mm-hmm. whole, like, millennials don't want to work, or their youth don't want to work. I'm like, no. I'm going to tell you, as, you know, an oldster, I mean, mm-hmm. I've been doing this a while. I've learned a lot about setting boundaries from people younger than me.
Mm-hmm.
I think when, especially in Hollywood, mm-hmm. I mean, I think some people are legitimately unprepared for how rigorous and honestly how difficult psychologically and emotionally it can be. And that's why I address that in the latter part of my book. Like, you
mm-hmm.
need to have your support systems
mm-hmm.
around you, because even if you have them, it will still be rough. But at the same time, that's very, it's to me, it's a minor sliver of any problems that occur. The big thing that people are complaining about now, I think a lot of established people are like, these young people just aren't tough enough, don't want to work, don't want to do this, are too soft, are too this or are too that. I'm like, no, they're not willing to put up with patterns of entrenched abuse and exploitation of all kinds. Different from not wanting to work. Every single young person I've known that has wanted to break into the industry has been like, hell yeah, I will work. I will be in it. I will go at it. They don't want to be abused. They're not willing to do that part of it, especially for no pay or little pay.
And
It doesn't work out.
as the resident young person here, yeah, we don't want to deal with the bullshit, 'cause like we're not getting paid as much as we're not getting paid as much either way. Like I like for Christ's sake, like we're not getting paid as much, so like why do we have to deal with this stuff? And it bewilders me. But I want to kind of get on something real quick, because I swear to God, we can probably go on this for like hours on end. But the one thing I think also, and I just want to say about your book. So this actually kind of touch on something real quick. There's the one of the chapters, the last chapter, as I like to call it. I want to talk about that because, like, the thing about that kind of shocked me, was kind of recognizing that someone that you probably like, kind of like, and again, just from my own experience, also, kind of like, was like, okay, like looked up to stuff, looked up to, kind of realized, oh wait, they're an asshole, and you know, as someone that you know is young and still very green into the industry, you know, I'm starting to having realize that. And when I remember you posted like an excerpt of that. Like when excerpt that I think it was it Vanity Fair? I think it was Vanity Fair. They did an excerpt of it, and I had just posted a review of Damon Lindelof's newest show, Mrs. Davis. Like I literally had just finished it up. I thought it was, and the show itself is really good. I do recommend it and stuff. But I just finished the show, finally finished, wrapped up and stuff, and I really enjoyed it and stuff. And I had recently went on through like a whole heel face turn with. Heel face turn with Lindelof, mainly because, you know, I is gonna make me is gonna date me a little bit, but like I was not the particular biggest fan of Prometheus, and I went and mainly because I had read the Alien Genesis script years beforehand, and so I kind of blamed a lot of the reasons why Prometheus kind of went down the crapper to Lindelof and to Scott, and to Ridley Scott and stuff. So that was through that for years. But then something changed my mind, and it wasn't The Leftovers, which I still need to kind of watch because I've heard good things, but it was HBO's Watchmen, which is a damn good show and stuff. And like I was like, okay, I'm gonna give him a second chance. And then Mrs. Davis came out and was like, okay, all right. And then the thing came out and I was like, shit. Just when I thought I was gonna give someone a second chance. But also another example, and you know, since we're talking about this right now, and I'm just gonna rip the Band-Aid off. Okay, I'm just gonna admit this right now to you, but like I use well, there is a particular creator who made one of my favorite shows of all time. It's still my favorite show, but my God, is he an asshole? And that is Joss Asshole Whedon. Let's just say for the past 3 to 4 years, I've had to do a whole just recontextualizing my love of the show versus my, you know, the whole art and artist thing, which you do get into, and do get into in a very great way, mind you. I really enjoy that bit. But it really kind of fucked me over a little bit with that. And like as the years gone on and stuff. I realized how much of an asshole he became, and just after the whole Charisma Carpenter thing, it was like revealed. It was like, oh yeah, fuck him, yeah. And just the enabling and stuff, and the fact that he wind up directing like one of the biggest movies of all time and stuff, kind of just goes to show just how rampant and these abuses can be and stuff. And but the thing is like. I guess as a fan of like pop culture stuff, how did you kind of like kind of recontextualize or rather come to terms with the fact that like some of the creators you might have thought were like really cool and stuff turned out to be assholes?
Well, I mean, that's still an ongoing thing for me. Honestly, the book, I think my whole career really has been about recontextualizing things. It's interesting because, sometimes people ask me like, oh, well, what won't you like? I think it's a very personal decision of what you will or won't watch another time or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm certainly, I don't feel qualified to make that decision for other people because I don't know that I can fully make that decision for myself. Like, day to day, that decision changes for me. But absolutely, I mean, I will tell you, there have been moments, and I'm not attaching any names to this because it's happened more than once. There are moments where I have felt physically ill, like physically nauseated, like not, and it's not just, oh, what I thought I knew was not the reality at all, but the deeper horror of thinking, even if it was only in a small way, even if I was just one molecule of their reputation, I helped this person. Oh God, what have I done? Like, I've definitely had that feeling many times. And it sucks because, you definitely recontextualize not just the work, but how much of what occurred was this person working the refs and working me over and or selling me a line, and was I gullible, or would anyone have bought that PR spin or that version of who they are? If I could put it in terms that I think are sort of like graspable or understandable, and I with the caveat that everyone is still working this stuff out for themselves, you are, I am, that's not going to be over today. It's not going to be over this year. It's an ongoing thing. The big picture is that our conception of what an artist should be and how that person should be allowed to behave is pretty fucked. And I think that it became fucked for a reason. A lot of reasons, a lot of things went into that. But one of the big reasons was it was thought to be to enable that. People thought we'll make more money and also we'll save money. If we're constantly cycling through people who have to deal with the artist and the abuse, like, well, if we're constantly cycling through new batches of actors because people quit the profession because they cannot take it anymore, then we keep pay down. We keep organizing down. We keep people in a state of fear and trembling so that they can't and don't want to and think it's wrong to fight back. And so that's the big dodge of the creative person has to be damaging regularly to the people around them. The big dodge that is enabled by that is, if there is an issue at this workplace or on this set, the issue is with you, the victim. You're the problem. You're the person who's being harmed regularly, systematically, formally or informally, institutionally, or just psychologically, financially. You're the problem for thinking there's a problem. And that worked. That worked. It kept costs down. It kept labor actions down. It kept organizing down. It kept press coverage way down. I didn't know what I didn't know in 2002. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just read my friend Alan Sepinwall's book about the OC, Welcome to the OC, which I highly recommend. It's really interesting and really fun. And that was a production where I, like, yeah, like people had some memories that were difficult, but I don't think it was a case of someone was behaving in an abusive manner. It was just like, it's hard to make TV over a period of years. It's really hard. It's hard. So you like, you have to overcorrect and be as proactive as possible when this industry has functioned on being not proactive, but non-reactive and blaming the victim. So, I think that we, for any number of reasons, an idea of who gets to even act like that, who gets to act in damaging, abusive, exploitative ways, and why, we're uncovering that, we're digging into that. How do those negative, bad dynamics that most people don't want, how do we undo them? And undoing them has to do with our mentalities and with coming together. And I mean, it makes me so happy that that in a way that people are saying to me, I felt seen by this book. You were describing a different set or a different workplace, but I went through the exact same thing. You're not alone. A lot of the book and a lot of my work has been the following sentence: you are not alone. It's not just you, and you're not wrong. So, like, I think that if I've done a little bit to push, and a lot of other journalists have too, to push us into reality, because what happens is imagination, fantasy, storytelling, spinning, whatever you want to call it, that's fine for the screen, but it's been way too prevalent behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Don't tell me a story of what you think your set is. Go talk to the people on that set and ask them what, you know, listen to people. Like, how many instances in my book, Harold Perrineau, at the cost of his peace of mind, and ultimately, it seemed to me anyway, at some cost to his career, brought up not just issues with one script, but the treatment of Black characters on the show, the number one show in the country. You know, I think that that's unbelievably heroic.
Yeah.
But I would be a bad journalist if I didn't say, look at the price he was forced to pay. I mean, it makes me crazy. Well, why do people in Hollywood put up with XYZ? Do you not see what happens to those who speak out?
Yeah.
So we've got to just, in terms of like, oh, well, I'm recontextualizing everything still. You know, the day the book came out, I wrote a piece about Angel and what Charisma Carpenter's work as an activist and then as an actor on screen meant to me. Because I felt like, you know, what I want to do is, you know, in one thing we can all do is take the focus away from the person who caused harm. I mean, yes, reckon with what they did, but what I want to, I feel like my entire career is like, let's swing the camera away from that charismatic harm doer and swing it around and say, what was it like what was it like for the people who had to live in that world? What was that? What did they go through? I mean, I gotta say, I don't think I have it on me, but I was very, very gratified by most of the responses to the book. But there was recently an article in the New Yorker about, you know, sort of like Hollywood tell-alls and, you know, Peter Biskin's work, like, you know, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls. He has a new book out about the industry. But my book was brought up too. And what the writer of the piece, Michael Shulman, said was, you know, something along the lines, and I'm paraphrasing, of, you know, Maureen Ryan spoke to the people who had to put up with this behavior, the assistants, you know, the junior people, the junior executives, the actors. I actually talk to people, a lot of my career is like, let's get away from this idea that we must focus all of our attention and energy on the charismatic creator who is usually looks a certain way, has a certain background, can get away with XYZ. Can we just, we're feeding the problem by constantly making it about them. And I'm not saying we shouldn't talk about them. Don't get me wrong. But like, what's it, what can we do as a series of communities to protect people from those who are either on the wrong path or want to go down the wrong path? How do we divert them back onto the right path? How do we protect the people who would be harmed by the people on the wrong path?
Yeah. And just to give a voice to those working behind the scenes, which normally isn't really told. Like, thankfully, to a certain extent this year, we kind of started to get those voices and stuff.
Yeah.
But normally, it's normally the A-list actor, writer, director, like, they're in front of the camera. They're doing the press tour.
Some of the stories that I've done in which people encountered a career consequence. I mean, every single one of my stories had certain number of senior people helping out. But there are a number of stories where the majority of my sources were, you know, costume designer, writer's assistant, script coordinator. Like, they're the people, like, they're not, like, and that's the message of hope that I want to give people. When people come together with an altruistic and positive intent and plan of action, it can work. It doesn't always work. I mean, I'm a realist. I live in America, right? It can work. I don't believe, I'm still in touch with everybody from the chapter on Lost. I'm still in touch with a lot of people who, from the book, none of those people, as far as I'm aware, who use their names has encountered negative career consequences because they came together as a group. You know what I mean? Like, in, yes, one person can make a difference. Many times one person has. But the big lie of Hollywood is like, well, if you take action against those with power, you will ultimately be destroyed. Now, that does happen. But there are ways, it doesn't always happen. You know, there are ways to do that admittedly, I'm not minimizing how difficult it is, because the book was really hard to do. Each story I do is really hard to do. But this idea, oh well, once you enter the gates of any commercial entertainment industry, you're absolutely powerless for all time. That's not true.
Yeah, that's bullshit.
It's bullshit. It's isolation. You know what abusers do to individuals in their lives, that's what the industry in certain cases does to entire groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're alone. No one believes you. The problem is you. Mm-hmm. You're ungrateful. Why are you always complaining? And by the way, here's another ration of shit.
Yes.
No, people are much more proactively comparing notes. And I do think several people said this online, like industry people in conversation too. It's like, well, they just gave thousands of industry professionals months and months and months to just hang out and talk with each other and compare notes. And that was a mistake. Yeah?
Yeah, no.
People came together and were like, oh, wait, I'm not the only person being asked to develop that project for 6 months for no money.
Yeah.
I'm not doing that anymore. You know?
I'm just also just thinking, like, just, you know, you could have resolved, I'm just like the CEO, just kind of like, you know, you could have resolved this earlier, but, you know.
Again, it becomes that bubble. I think sometimes these villains, like, mm-hmm. they like, you know.
Disaster of the world.
The seeds of their own destruction are contained within their own hubris, you know. It's mm-hmm. like, well, okay, I could have told you, you could have told them, I could have told you that rank and file workers at all levels,
mm-hmm.
many professions in the industry, were fed up. They don't want to strike. They will strike because this is not sustainable. Mm-hmm. And I especially think what a lot of people did was not just talk the talk about having an inclusive industry, but literally walk the walk, because mm-hmm. they're seeing all of these different ladders of ascending and staying within the industry, or mm-hmm. at least having that a shot at that. Was going away.
Yeah.
The ladders that they used to get anywhere, in their very difficult ladders, even those very difficult ladders, were being set on fire.
Yeah, like the assistant to like series writer, I forgot the term, but like the assistant,
staff writer,
the assistant, yeah. The staff writer.
Thank you very much. It's gone. Yeah. And that's like, so I still think that there are massive headwinds in the industry. I really do. Like, it's no one I know. Everyone's relieved the strikes are over. No one thinks that the industry is fixed. But what I do think is different is that people's expectations for how their workplaces should function are different.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing. And the lies they've been told about, like, well, you're just a complainer. You just don't understand hard work. You just don't understand this industry. You just don't know. No, also, no. People are not going to put up with the old, same old, the system as it was, I hope. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, I don't think the industry is fixed, but if we can at least talk honestly about what the ongoing problems are, that's not nothing.
Yeah, no, I definitely think so. And I do think, and I hope, Jesus fucking Christ, I hope that moving forward, we'll be more honest about like the workplace, like mm-hmm. just the workplace and how we want it and how, you know, we should be treated in the workplace.
Absolutely.
Especially in an industry that is self-governed and really, I would say it has no checks and balances, but it doesn't have really a checks and balance system.
No, like, and this is what's so funny to me is like people are like, well, Hollywood can't change. Hollywood has imposed its own set of regulations on itself.
Mm-hmm.
The MPAA is not a government thing.
Yeah,
the Hays Code that came into force in the early 30s in the industry, which codified racism, which codified white people as the only, more or less the only people that could be lead characters and most of the characters at all, that codified that, you know, homosexuality was wrong,
mm-hmm.
and could not even be referred to. The industry imposed that on itself. No one made them do that. Nobody made the so when people are like, well, the industry can't change. The industry changes all the time.
Yeah.
Industry, again, like I love to point to this example from 90 years ago. The Hays Code was something the industry did to itself.
Mm-hmm.
No one made them.
Yeah.
But they are like the industry is constantly doing staying just one step ahead of potential government regulation. And it doesn't, you know, they've successfully evaded government regulation and even scrutiny, really, for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember I was very much part of a wave of people who were excited when the Equal Opportunity Office began looking into the hiring of directors. And the EEOC won't talk, but like, you know, the various parties that helped make that turn that into a case that the EEOC looked at, especially when it came to the hiring of women directors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the EEOC opened an investigation to great fanfare. That was 8 years ago, 7 years ago. And if there's been any resolution, I have not heard about it. And so the industry is ever shape-shifting, ever creative. But the good news is there are any number of people within it who are like, I don't want to be part of something that is fundamentally exploitative and abusive. And those people are not now viewed as the weirdos over in the corner. Like, they always were there. There always have been altruistic, good-hearted people in the industry. They now have more recognition and more levers to pull and buttons to press,
mm-hmm.
especially when they come together in groups.
Yeah, and yeah, no, and definitely. And I've started seeing that just more and more, and I'm happy for them, because, like, you know, the more, like, altruistic, good-hearted people who, like, genuinely, like, want to not only to make a good story and do good story and have good production stuff, but also, like, want to bring people up and stuff, like.
But I still don't understand an industry that looks at someone like, who, there are any number of creative people I could name who created a film script, who directed, who created a TV show that you love or I love,
mm-hmm.
who are good people,
mm-hmm.
but still the myth persists that if somebody is a respectful, humane human being to work with, they're probably not as creative, right? Like, I swear to God, that is still a very prevalent idea.
Jesus.
That if someone is respectful, humane, empathic, compassionate, and proactively looking out for people's welfare, they probably can't create well. And I'm like, or they're not as creative as that person over there who's a complete raging jerk. Like, it's such a stereotype, and I feel like it's so woven into how we've portrayed creativity, whether it's in journalist circles or with on screens, whatever it is. We need to get away from this idea that in order to do your creative work,
mm-hmm.
it's probably beneficial to the work if you're routinely damaging to other human beings. It not only isn't beneficial to the work, it's certainly not beneficial to the people around you.
Yeah, like, you don't have to be an asshole to be a boss, essentially.
No, absolutely not. And I think,
like, you can be a good boss, but not an asshole.
There are a number of people that I've written about who I think are frankly not talented and were hacks, but somehow managed upward and were duplicitous enough or had enough self-preservation to climb the ladder. So there are some number of people who are abusive and who are jerks and who are exploitative in any number of ways that were not what I would consider like creatively gifted. But there is also, not just in my own reporting, but across the range of industry reporting over the years, there are a number of people who are legitimately talented. And I sit there and the question in my mind that rattles around sometimes is, why would you shit on your own gift that way? Why would you shit on your own creative gifts?
Mm-hmm.
All the people around you, all they wanted to do was help you realize your gifts, help you realize your vision.
Yeah.
And all you had to do was reach a very not high bar of behavior. And they would have gone to the ends of the earth to help you, the creator, realize that story, realize that vision. And it's like, wow, the number of people who just cannot even clear that low bar. And in the process, in my view, diminished their work and made it worse.
it's really empathy. Like throughout this conversation, yes. I've just been thinking just the word empathy has just been like, oh, like just
what kind of really artist are you if you completely lack empathy?
Yeah.
And why are you making art then? This is my question. This is like we're going back into like fundamentally, I believe, you know, people create art for themselves, you know, in their home studios or wherever. Like, yeah, art can just be a thing you do for yourself. But people who are in a commercial sphere trying to tell a story of some kind, the point is you want to connect with other people.
Yeah.
If you want to connect with other people, but also completely not only not have empathy, but, you know, make others suffer for sport, I don't understand why you want to, why are you, I mean, it's mind blowing to me, I guess. I mean, here's the thing, at the end of the day, there are aspects of this that I think I will never understand. And maybe that's in a weird way, a good thing, because, and I think when I get into the spirals of like, how much did I enable? How much did I do to enable bad patterns? I certainly feel like I have my share of responsibility or just norms to rethink. But at the same time, I'm like, I just made the assumption that I think a lot of us do, which is an artist wants to connect with other human beings through their story.
Yeah.
And I guess I fundamentally feel like that's cool.
Yeah.
I want that. That's why I devoted my adult life to writing about that.
No, same here and stuff. And yeah, but it's just like, and when you have a creator that doesn't have that empathy, it's just like, what the fuck are you doing then? Why are you here?
And I think some of it is, you know, perhaps at some point they encountered circumstances in which they felt there was no empathy for them. Okay, legitimately, that can be an issue. People can feel, you know, with all the success and the money and the awards in the world, people can feel bereft in like a poverty of their soul. That is certainly a thing that happens. But then that's, if you have the resources and the status, then go get the help that you need. Go figure out why it is that you feel that enacting your issues on other human beings in a consistently damaging way, why do you feel like that's okay? I mean, I'll bring up Melinda Shue Taylor. Working at Medium, according to a number of people I've talked to, for Glenn Gordon Caron was horrible. They alleged, you know, very difficult work environments. Working at Lost, I genuinely, like, I don't even know what to say anymore. She worked there too. She's worked a number of tough environments. And what a lot of people in this industry do is they say, well, I had to go through X, Y, and Z. Now it's my turn. And man, if that's what you think art is, I don't want your art. You know, take it, go out and backyard and take your script and light it on fire. I don't want it. I don't, I'm like, if your idea is I encountered abuse, damage, lack of empathy, lack of compassion, and active efforts to damage and exploit others, and I want to continue that, fuck your art.
Yeah. Like, that's just, I know. And I'm just, sorry, as soon as you said that, I was just like,
What is that? And the thing is, I don't accept, well, I had to be this way because I went through blah, blah, blah when I was starting out.
It's like,
you cannot know the thousands of people I've talked to who encountered shit and then did not turn around and become shitty people to work with.
Yeah, like, it's just...
being a human being, being an adult.
I'm just, the more I think about this, the more I'm just like, that's territory. That's just... you can see the things stirring around my brain just being like...
yeah, well, because, you know, like, look, we all... I feel, and I'm not speaking for you, but like... we all absorb a lot of stuff from the culture, from the world, from storytelling. Some of it's great. Some of it's less great. But the stuff that I've absorbed that I think has stuck around and really been useful for me in my life is like, it's possible to share your work or your stories or the things that matter to you with the world in a way that doesn't discount the things in life that are hard, but doesn't damage other people. I just, I feel like in a way I've become a preacher over the past few years, especially this year with the book coming out. And the good word that I'm preaching is that there are so many people who had opportunities to enact the damaging patterns that they saw or went through on others and chose not to. So nobody in this industry gets to tell me they had no choice. There are certain instances where someone was so low level that they didn't have a choice. Like, I'm not saying that everybody has autonomy. There are a number of people, I would say the majority of people who are sit in the industry who say, well, I had no choice because of X. No, you did have a choice. You just didn't want to take the consequences of what making the right choice would have been.
And to be honest, like we were talking about this earlier, but those are the scary people.
And that's the thing. The people that scare me the most are the people who won't admit to themselves that that's what they're doing. I will make my success. I will crawl over the bodies of the people that were damaged and exploited and tossed down to the trash heap. I will crawl over those bodies and not admit to myself that that's what I'm doing. Okay. I mean, that's the thing. That this is the glitch in my brain. I swear to God. At least admit it to yourself. At least be honest with yourself about what you did and why you did it. There are some people in this industry that got enough chances that can't be redeemed in the sense of getting power over others in the industry again. I will always believe that every living human brain being drawing breath can go on a path of atonement and amends. I do believe that. That's their own path. Some people, Scott Rudin, no more chances. You get no more chances to have power over people in the industry. Do you have endless chances every day that you're drawing breath to make amends, to go down a different path? Sure. Do you get more chances within this very specific industry? Absolutely not.
Not.
No.
No, just
You don't get to say, no one gets to say, well, I had no choice or it had to be that way. I've seen time and again people with far less power in most cases not making that decision. Not going down that path, making a more humane choice. No one gets to tell me, especially if they have status, money, power, access, all the rest, you know.
In reality, they're really providing grace. Grace for a situation, for grace, which is a very, and grace is a hard thing to do.
It's very hard. It's very hard. But I feel like, the point of me at this point in life is this. I have enough juice. People know my name, some people, not everyone, but within the industry, more or less, a fair number of people know who I am. If I'm not going to use the juice and the status and the connections that I have to draw attention to problems that need to be addressed, to draw attention to examples of non-damaging and even, humane behavior that need to be celebrated, what is the point of me? If people aren't going to use their juice or their status or their whatever, then if you're not going to use the status that you have or the protection or insulation that you have to help other people, just admit it. Just admit I'm only out for myself. I'm not going to use any of the advantages that I have to make things even 1% better for other people with less power than me. Just admit it. Just say it.
And we can be done with you. But yeah, no, and just on that front, I guess one thing I really want to ask is like just the response of the book. And you know, we've been talking about it throughout the time, like the book and even mentioning stuff, but like in terms of the critical response, because if I'm not mistaken, this is your first book, correct?
It is my first book, yes.
Yeah, so like how has that been for you? Like in terms of critical reception, like in terms of just and also people like just talking about it and stuff, or at least in our circles. Talking about it and stuff. Like, does it feel overwhelming? Does it feel, how does it feel?
To make your first book a very heavily reported thing that had to be very heavily lawyered on a very intense and compressed time frame, I wouldn't recommend. So it was really, really, really hard. I mean, elements of the book, look, I mean, there's been pieces of the Sleepy Hollow story that I've been gathering for years, but the most concentrated, intense part of the work was 2021, 2022, and then actually into this year. I wouldn't say that we had a fully locked book until March or so, and even after that I found a couple of errors that I fixed, fortunately, before it was too late. But I gotta say, it's funny because I re-landscaped my entire yard starting April, May into June because I was like, the waiting is indeed, Tom Petty, the hardest part. It's very hard. It's very hard. Because I will be honest, it was such a rough process and rough in terms of just the sheer logistics of doing all the interviews, confronting people who could hire a lot of very expensive lawyers to, make the process more hard. Just having doing tough interviews, even with people, talking to people who'd been through horrific things, some of my interview transcripts are just like, oh my God, oh wow, oh no, I'm sorry. Like it's like, but on top of all that, I'd done work in these arenas. I've done this kind of reporting and certainly on inclusion, on race, on sexism, all of that for 20, 25 years. It's not like I'm new to this, but I really wondered, are people going to want to sit down and sit with, as you found, like sitting with this stuff is hard. It's really like, if it was hard to write, so I know it's hard to process. I believe me, I have compassion for the folks that are like, oh, it took me a long time to read the, I'm like, yep, took me a long time to process it in my own brain. I get it. So by the end, that's all prelude to say, by the end, I had two goals for the book. I want to be proud of it. Look, even if it goes kerplat, just splat, nobody cares. No, makes no ripple. I want to be proud of what I did, and I want to not get sued. I like, in a weird way, I think I saved myself by having that as my low expectation bars. It's like, don't want to be in court over this. I just really, I've and when I tell you how much time I've spent with lawyers over various stories and this book over the past 6 years, I'm whatever number you think of, it's going to be too low, the number of hours. So I feel like I really have like a basically, honorary doctorate, JD, like an honorary lawyer over here. I feel like get up in court and talk semi-intelligently about this stuff. But so I didn't know what the response would be. And I got to tell you, the night before, weirdly enough, like, so the, I work with the team at Vanity Fair to do a version of that last chapter for print. And that came out a week before the book came out. And so the days before that came out, I was like, pins and needles, man. Because people loved that show and I did too. Like I'm telling you, Santa Claus is not only not real, but he's kind of a dick. Like I'm the anti-Claus, really. That's what I call myself sometimes. I visit once a year to tell you something terrible. So the response, I'll start in stages. The response to the lost chapter, if that exact chapter had appeared either in the book or in Vanity Fair 5 years earlier, the response would have been different. There would have been a lot more, Lizard, you just did this for clicks and you just don't understand. And I think the groundwork had been laid over a period of years for people to have a different take on what using and abusing Hollywood power looks like. And also, not for nothing, the people who I spoke to for that chapter had reached points in their careers where they were like, I'm not going to sit on this anymore and have it fester in my soul. This was the reality and I'm not going to be quiet about it anymore. And they felt they could, finally speak on it. So that was brave. Still, I still take my hat off to all the sources for that, but for everything, really. Because, the reviews were rolling in by then, and I don't have words to express how much more, like, it's genuinely, I wanted people to like what I worked hard on. The positive response was overwhelming in a good way. Sometimes it was just kind of like, I gotta turn off the old computer and stop looking at the phone, like that, one of those, because it's like, it's a lot of people are coming at you with their emotions and their, but it was overwhelmingly gratifying, just validating. I mean, on a soul level, as a human being, to have my first book be something that people felt was useful, and then, just sold pretty well, and my editors and my team at the publisher were happy. You want to do that too, right?
No,
You don't want to go to
that's
like, director jail, like where your movie flops and then you get fired from the film,
yeah.
So, I got, I mean, just one high point. You know, I love Star Trek Strange New Worlds. And one of the writers for that show, Bill Wolkoff, not him, someone else I know, sent me a photo of Bill with a sentence from my book on his picket sign. And I'm like, I had to pull over my car at the side of the road and just, I cried. You know, I was like, people felt seen. They felt it was useful. They felt it was valuable. And I think whether we're talking about industry professionals or just members of the public or people in fandoms, however you want to slice it, the main response that I got was, some of these truths are difficult truths, but I'm glad you have brought them to light. And, you know, the last third of the book is, you know, solutions, ideas, examples of people doing it better. And there was never going to be a version of the book where that wasn't part of it, because I don't believe in bleakness. I don't believe in, you know, I have moments of despair. I don't want to put out a book that only induces despair, because what use is that? People have enough sources of potential despair in their lives.
Yeah. Yeah. Most definitely.
Open your phone for like more than 30 seconds and it's like, despair, my old friend.
Or rather, hello, darkness, my old friend.
Right? Exactly. It's like, that would always be my test for, like, I don't go on Twitter anymore, but my test, like, how long before I feel extreme existential dread? Okay, 8 seconds. All right, cool. We did it.
You know, I've been doing that a lot lately on Twitter and stuff. There's even days where I've had to shut that off.
Blue Sky and Instagram, they feel like it's not quite as like burning my brain into pieces. But yeah, the response to the book was, I mean, the timing couldn't have, I mean, I don't want people to have gone through the stress of the strikes. I'm not saying yay strikes. I'm saying the timing of it was certainly very good in terms of everyone, you know, a lot of media sources were like, come talk about why are people striking? And I'm like, I can tell you that. Let me do my thing, you know? So it was a lot. I mean, one thing I didn't realize at first, I will just say, and this is kind of a semi-funny thing, if you ever hear about an actor or performer or anyone in the arts completely going haywire while on a press junket, I get it. I get it now. I get it 100%. I'm not condoning it, but I get it, because on a day where I did like 5 interviews, or even, you know, there was one day where on radio, I did like 12 radio interviews, kabam, kabam, kabam. Over 4 hours. I was like, my brain is just fully dead forever, I think. So it's draining, you know, to do a press junket, to do a lot of press. It's draining. Not that I wasn't mostly up for it, but it was like, it took me a while to realize that even talking about things I want to talk about and want to highlight and want to address, I can't do like 6 of those per day or I'll lose my mind.
Yeah, like I'm just imagining, like, you know, actors like doing like press junkets and probably being asked the same thing over and over again.
And I used to be salty about that. I'm going to tell you, I would be real salty if I got a good quote from someone, then I see it in someone else's story. I'm like, now I get it. I get it. You're only one human being. You only got so many answers to the same questions.
Like, I'm just now thinking of Martin Scorsese being asked about goddamn superhero movies.
Right? The poor guy.
And he's like, the man's 78 years old. He is...
Let him live. Let him live. Let Grandpa live.
Yeah, yeah, no.
He's
not interested in that.
To just, you know, give some praise to our side of the street. You know, people on the street. Like, look. Most of the interviews were lovely. They were great. You know, I enjoyed reading what people had to say. But I got to say, one of the things that was most meaningful to me is like opening up Instagram and people tagging me or DMing me and saying in a profound way that they felt seen. Total strangers. Never met them before. But like, I saw what you wrote about the industry and I felt seen and I felt like I like validated it. I'm so lucky that I got to, through this group effort, which was not just me. It was, you know, my editor, Rakia Clark, the team at the publisher, every source in the book, named, not named, everyone came together to be an engine of validation for those in the industry saying, we can do better. And what I was put through was not okay. And I don't, how can we, what can I do? What can I be part of? And I think, yeah, just seeing those kinds of reactions, the DMs, the emails I got from, I mean, the day that Kerry Washington tagged me on Instagram, I'm like, what's happening? Who am I? Am I alive? I died. I'm dying. I'm dying in a good way. It was amazing. I mean, really, when people like the phrase beyond my wildest dreams, I just can't overemphasize that. Like the response was really gratifying. And every so often, here's what I thought there'd be a lot more of, if I'm honest. I thought there'd be a lot more of like, well, she's the woke police, like that whole thing. Like I thought that crowd would come after me. And I was like, all right, I get whatever. I mean, I'm just okay. Yeah, I mean, saying racism is bad, if that makes me the woke police, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. Like,
No, that crowd, I just don't know. Like,
but I
and this
thought,
is
but
in
here, real
the
talk, I thought certain fandoms would come after me. I thought like, reactionary people who get clicks and get engagement through, hate mobbing. Like the thing is, I'm a woman on the internet. I'm a woman on the internet who's called out rape culture. I'm a woman, I've called out, there are certain shows that are like, man, you know what you don't want to do? Be a woman writing about sexual violence on Game of Thrones. Man, you will not have a good week. I'm just telling you right now. Like that's not just me. So like I've been through it, as many people have, unfortunately, on social media. So I just thought, are all my socials going to become unusable because, certain people get their clicks and get their content from like coming after people just trying to make the world less shitty. I don't know, but like none of that happened. Or every so often I would get a comment like that, but I would be like, okay, that good luck, block, but have a great life. Yeah, it was amazing. It was a lot. It was a lot to process after having been down this rabbit hole of writing the book. It was like, now I'm in the world and doing stuff and with people want to talk. I'm like, it's like, oh, okay, now I gotta like put on clean clothes, I guess, and like, comb my hair. It's weird.
No, definitely. And I guess a follow-up question, and this will probably be our final really question of this conversation and stuff. What's next? Just for you in general, or just what's next?
I do want to write another book, and everyone's like, write another book about the strikes. And I'm like, no. If I'm honest, look, never say never. I don't know what more I have to say about the industry, and no, nobody likes a broken record. Like we've all seen that filmmaker who's where we're like, haven't you made this film 3 times already? Like I don't get it. Like you know what I mean? Like you're just making a variation of a theme. Like I don't know that this is. Yeah, whatever. No one wants to be the person who, I don't want people to get tired of me or my voice or my work. So I want to write another book, another nonfiction book. I don't necessarily want to say what it's about, but it's in a different arena. I do think, because I think about storytelling, I do think I would write to some degree, maybe in that book about the uses and misuses of storytelling, especially commercial storytelling. But I think I'll still knock out the occasional journalistic thing, but probably more books are in my future, I would hope. I hope
I hope
that's
so as well, because this was amazing. Like, again, I've sang my praises about it and stuff throughout the episode and stuff, but this was amazing. This was a nice therapy session for me. And just like, this really, because look, I'm very green when it comes to this industry. Like, I wanted to be in this industry. I went to college for this industry and stuff. But within like the last year or so, I moved out to LA and I finally got my job on, I'm just gonna say it right now because it's been 2 years, but it's been a year so far. I got my first job on Dr. Phil and stuff. And just, that was very eye-opening. I think that and then this was probably the most eye-opening experience I've had, working in the trenches on studio lots and stuff. And just, it's very eye-opening and stuff. And it gave me a lot of perspective and a lot of things that hopefully, when I hopefully become up in the levels and stuff, like I will remember and want to emulate in the workplace. Because like no one should have to go through that shit. No one should have to go through that shit in the book and the various pieces in the book and stuff. Like, it should be a healthy work environment where people are encouraged. We're creating fiction, for crying out loud.
I couldn't agree more. And like the what I would want to leave your listeners with is that you specifically, you're not alone. You're not alone. The industry can be a lonely place. It can be a very isolating place. It is definitely a place that has had me questioning reality many times. Like, am I, like, you get the runaround from PR, you get, you know, like people are trying to like make you think that your impressions and your thoughts are erroneous, or like I'm the problem, whatever. But no, you're, in terms of the industry as a whole, I just want people to know, especially at the lower levels, it can seem very difficult to affect change. And I very much believe that people should protect their mental health, their physical safety, and their financial future to the extent that they can, because not everyone has the same amount of power or protection or pull or money or whatever. So, but that being said, even psychologically, even if even if someone is in a bad situation or trying to get out or whatever, just knowing that you're not alone, I hope that that can help. And if there's been any success in the story of saying like basically you're not alone, it's thousands of sources across many publications, across many books, and so I hope that there's real relief to be had from that, and real hope and optimism to be had from that, you know, that the people who want to have humane, constructive, thrifty, good workplaces where they can pay their bills and also get to be human beings on and off the clock, the majority of people in the industry also want that. And anyone who tells you different has an agenda that I would have questions about.
Most definitely. Well, anyways, that about wraps up this very, very long and honestly great in conversation with Mo Ryan. You can find her book in bookstores all around the country and stuff. Where can the good people find you?
The good people can find me. MoRyan.com has a lot of my links. I'm spending more time on socials over on Blue Sky. I've been trying to hand out codes for that too. I've got to do that, like, another round of that. I'm also on Instagram more, MoRyan66. On Blue Sky, I'm MoRyan.bsky.com. I'm also made a tiny little foray into Threads, but if you look for me on MoRyan.com, you'll see all the places to find me. And there's a lot more links to my work there, as well as links to coverage of the book if you're in podcasts. So if people want to keep delving in, that's where they can go.
Feel free to follow us on all our social media platforms. We're on Twitter at Convo with Two Geeks. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Conversation with Two Geeks. And if you want to send us an email with anything from this episode or one of our previous episodes, we're at conversationwithtwogeeks@gmail.com. And we're also on TikTok at Conversation with Two Geeks.
And anyways, have a nice day, everyone, and we'll see you later. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.